But I'm going to treat you to something, perhaps, I don't know for sure, but I'm going to treat you to something that I know you haven't experienced yet at the feast, because no speaker has gone over time. Not promising for sure, one way or the other, but you never know when you get into a subject that's as much fun as this one is. That song that they just sang expresses it maybe more than we realize. Because the attitude, the political or the spiritual climate that's going to exist in the period of time that this day represents is going to be more joyous than perhaps we could even begin to imagine. The Feast of Tabernacles is over. But it's not without significance as it relates to this day. This day is separate of the feast. God identifies it separately, but did you realize how rare its mention is? From what I can find, it's only mentioned once directly in the Old Testament. And only once is an incidental reference in the New. Like the wave sheaf, mentioned very rarely, but yet extremely significant. Today I want to explain to you the significance of this day, not only as it relates to the recipients of its benefit, but as it relates to each of us as well, because we have a part in the fulfillment of this day. I'm going to be throwing a lot of information at you. In some cases where the verses are very familiar, I'm just going to read them and go through them a lot and save a lot of time that way. Less well-known verses we'll probably take and read together. I just thought I'd make that comment to begin with. But this day is not well-known, even in religious circles, even in the circles of those who keep God's holy days. One time I attended a Messianic seminar that was going to explain the meanings of the holy days, and they had these wonderful charts on the wall. And they understood a great deal. But conspicuous by its absence was this particular day. It wasn't even on their charts. It wasn't on their radar screen. They were clueless as to what it means or the fact that it even exists. And among those of our persuasion, there are many odd ideas out there. I'm amazed sometimes at the things that people come up with. And those ideas generate confusion. They generate nagging doubts. A little error goes a long way in skewing the foundations of truth. With God's holy days, we lay a foundation of truth. Truth about what God's plan is and how it's going to work. And that is something that God's called out ones should know very well. I've even found one fellow online who associates the 7 days of unleavened bread as illustrating the millennial age. He claims to be shining a new light on the subject. I really don't accept his premise other than perhaps the component of cleansing society of sin, which is also a function of the millennial age. But the days of unleavened bread pictures putting sin out of our lives. That's its primary focus. And the 7 days represent a full generation, which poses a corresponding comparison to the 7 days of tabernacles. And then there's a long period afterwards, that period of time where God's true saints await the resurrection. But let's keep in mind the basic outline. God's holy days, the spring holy days, address the issues relating to personal salvation, whereas the fall holy days represent the plan of God as it regards world salvation. The 7 days of the millennial age pictures, among other things, putting sin out of society. Sin will first be removed from the governmental structure. And isn't that good news? The saints are going to rule with Christ over the earth. The governments as we know them are going to be closed down, closed out, taken over. Truth will be restored, as we know in Isaiah 11, verse 9, that the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. Is the ocean bottom covered with water? In most areas, I think it is. The earth will have its destructive elements removed. We can read of that in Revelation 11, verse 18, where he is going to destroy them which destroy the earth. But even in that day, individuals are still going to have to choose. To choose to worship God appropriately and then enter themselves into the conversion process. And it is a process. If people aren't ready, then God has set up a sacrificial or ceremonial system to make them ready. And we spoke of that last year here at the feast. Once they are ready, they can accept Christ's atoning sacrifice and complete a lifetime of overcoming personal sins. That's the situation during the 1,000 years. But today we're not talking about the 1,000 years. There's another day, a day after the millennial age. And how do we know that? It's found in Leviticus 23, starting in verse 34, where it says, "Speak unto the children of Israel, saying, the 15th day of the 7th month shall be the Feast of Tabernacles for 7 days unto the Lord." That's pretty clear. "On the first day shall be an holy convocation. You shall do no servile work therein. 7 days you shall offer an offering made by fire unto the Lord." So it's clear that the Feast of Tabernacles is only 7 days. But then he goes on to say, "On the 8th day, and what could be clearer than this is the day after the 7 days of Tabernacles, "on the 8th day shall be an holy convocation unto you, and you shall offer an offering made by fire unto the Lord. It is a solemn assembly, and you shall do no servile work therein." I want each of us to understand the great significance of this 8th day and what it means. What it means and how it will come to pass is something that we understand in this age as no previous generation has understood. We can't fault them for it necessarily. But because of the heritage that we've been given with our calling, the heritage of having these days and of coming to understand their meaning, we understand these days, or we understand this day in particular, to a degree that the world has not enjoyed. So let's appreciate what we have. In order to understand the 8th day, we need to understand the resurrections from the dead and the matter of eternal judgment. The resurrections play a major part in the fulfillment of this interval of time. In Hebrews 6, we have the most fundamental structure of our religious understanding laid out before us. We know these verses. They're very familiar. Hebrews 6, the first couple of verses. Very short and very explicit. Where Paul urges his readers by saying, "Therefore, leaving the principles of the doctrine of Christ, let us go on unto perfection, not laying again the foundation. And here he explains what the foundation is. Repentance from dead works. Faith towards God. The doctrine of baptisms. And of the laying on of hands. And of the resurrection of the dead and eternal judgment. I want to pose to you that it isn't possible to go on to perfection without understanding the fundamental components that lead to it. It's not just perfection in knowledge. We can know all these things, but God intends that we also have them in our repertoire of experiences. We not only know these things, but we must have experienced repentance, faith, baptism, laying on of hands with the receipt of God's Spirit. And depending on our life situation, we look forward to the resurrection of the dead and of eternal judgment. These will not only be things that we know, these are things that we are to experience. We shouldn't dismiss these as unimportant. We shouldn't take any of these and say, well, I can move around that and move on to perfection even though I don't get it. No, we should also get it. They're important. Because if we're going to represent God's truth to others, we have to understand these things ourselves. Let me pause here for a moment and give you some definitions. I'm going to be throwing some terms around. And just to make it clear what I mean, I want to at least have this awareness in your mind. We're going to use the word judgment quite a lot. We've used it already there in Hebrews 6, 2. When we think of judgment, we typically think of a sentencing event. And if you were at our Bible study last night, this was brought out. That judgment is not just condemnation. That's what the world usually thinks when it hears that word. No, there is also a period of evaluation that comes before sentencing. So when you see the word judgment, don't always think of sentencing. Don't always think of condemnation. Judgment is also judgment to reward. Because Christ is going to judge both his saints and the wicked. Different destinies, different outcomes, but they both fall under the term judgment. Now, as we know from verses in Peter, that judgment is now upon the house of God. That's not condemnation. It is our period of evaluation. And it remains to be seen how we fare at the end. Another term that I'll be using is the Great White Throne Judgment. That is a period of evaluative judgment for those who were never provided opportunity. Don't think of the Great White Throne as a single day. It's a period of time. It's an era composed of at least decades, perhaps a full lifetime, a full generation. It's not some short-term event. I'll also be referring to the post-millennial age, which is basically one and the same as the Great White Throne Judgment, which is one and the same as the Second Resurrection era. Christ spoke more of the Second Resurrection era than he did of any other. I don't know if you've ever noticed that. I'm going to also mention the white cloud harvest. That's different. That's not one and the same as the Great White Throne Judgment. The white cloud harvest is a short-term event. It is the sentencing event. It's the part of judgment where sentencing is put down. We can read of the white cloud harvest in Revelation 14, verses 14 to 16. And then there is the other part of that same event. It's not referred to by the same name, but it's later in chapter 14 of Revelation, which talks about the reaping of the grapes of wrath. The last great day is, for the most part, an end time revelation. Previous generations haven't understood it. It's first mentioned in Leviticus 23:36 as the eighth day. And we read that a little while ago. The next place it's mentioned is in Deuteronomy 16:18, which presents a similar description of the Feast of Tabernacles, but where it comes to the point in time where you would expect it to mention the eighth day, it doesn't. Doesn't mention it. In the place where you think it should be mentioned, it talks about justice and judgment. The next specific mention is found in John chapter 7, verses 37, John 7, 37, where we get the name for this day. John 7, 37. And we know this has to do with the Feast of, just shortly after the Feast of Tabernacles. In that last day, that great day of the feast, Jesus stood and cried, saying, "If any man thirst, let him come unto me and drink. He that believes on me, as the Scriptures have said, out of his belly shall flow rivers of living water." And in chapter 8, he goes on to address the subject of judgment and justice. The same thing that we found in Deuteronomy 16 in the place where it should have mentioned this day, but it doesn't specifically. Have you realized that the event that's described right after this, the woman taken in the act of adultery, do you realize that that was either the last great day itself, depending on how you read the account here, or it was the day immediately after? Some people see verse 37 in John 7 as referring to the seventh day of the feast. Others see it as being the eighth day afterwards. But the woman taken in adultery is in the same context. No doubt about her guilt. But did you notice that all of her accusers were taken away? And he turned and said to her, "Go and sin no more." That message carries again the same general theme of this last day. Our accusers are going to be taken away. And we'll come to that. And the instruction to those living in that era is go and sin no more. One thing we do know for sure, that people were still there in Jerusalem after the feast. We can read that from the context. But this era of the last great day is bracketed by two of the fundamental events that we know of as being the fundamental doctrines of God's church. This era is bracketed by resurrections. For that matter, so is the Christian era. And for that matter, so is the millennium. The millennium begins at the first resurrection, and it ends about the time of the second. The last great day begins with the second resurrection, and it ends with the third. Resurrections are woven into the framework of God's plan. I want to present to you a scenario regarding the last great day. And I want to go into a lot more detail than perhaps you've ever heard before. I never have. Maybe you were lucky and you did. But I want to explain how this last great day is going to play out. I'm going to take the elements that we know from the Scriptures, and I'm going to intersperse among them some practical, logical deductions that show how this period of time works. But it's important to understand the resurrections, and it's important to understand the millennial kingdom. The second resurrection period opens the opportunity for salvation for all of the rest of the world, all of those who were never called, all of those who were blinded for whatever reason, all of those who never lived in a society where it was possible for them to have the experience that we have been privileged to have. The third concludes it, bringing all of the rest of humanity to their sentencing phase of judgment. We should always keep in mind that the judgment is presently on the Church of God, and that is an evaluative judgment, as we read in 1 Peter 4:17, where it says, "For the time is come that judgment must begin at the house of God. And if it first begins at us, what shall be the end of them that obey not the gospel of God?" The world's religions tend to overfocus on the condemnative aspect of judgment, complicated by their predestination ideas and the once saved, always saved kind of thinking. Those can cloud the issues greatly. There is going to be an event that will bring people together in a way that hopefully we can come to better understand. It's found in Matthew chapter 25, and it begins in verse 31. This is Christ speaking, and I think we can be confident that he knew what he was talking about, and he was giving it to his disciples straight. He said, "When the Son of Man shall come in his glory, and all the angels with him, all the holy angels with him, then shall he sit upon the throne of his glory." We recognize that as the beginning of the millennial age, right after the second coming. "And before him shall be gathered all nations, and he shall separate them one from another, as a shepherd divides his sheep from the goats." This is going to involve everyone. The thing is, not everyone is going to be living at the same point in time. But that will be explained. And in verse 33, he talks about a segregation process where he sets those who have become sheep on one hand and those who have become goats or remained goats on the other. And it's interesting to notice that the way he evaluates these people is not their strict adherence to his law, but rather their regard for one another. I won't belabor that at this point. I just wanted to point it out. "But those on his right hand will be brought into the family of God, and those on his left will go away," as it says in verse 46, "into everlasting punishment, but the righteous into life eternal." There is going to be a period of opportunity where all nations are before him. They're going to have the opportunity to learn his way. And then at the end of it all, there's a sentencing event where he divides them according to their personal situations. In order to understand the last great day, we ought to understand a little bit about the millennial age, that period of time between the first resurrection and the second. And we know Revelation chapter 20, verse 5, where the rest of the dead live not again till the 1,000 years were finished. Very clear. That is fundamental to our understanding of God's plan in that regard. There's going to be a resurrection before the millennial age, and there's going to be another one after it. The last great day is similar, but it's going to be populated by people raised from the dead, primarily. The millennial age, on the other hand, is populated by those who survive the great tribulation physically and live on over into that age. The last great day is populated by those who are raised to be given the opportunity for salvation that they never had. And when you think about it, That is a fantastic aspect of God's plan that this world just doesn't have in their bag of explanations. Those who live and die during the millennial age sleep through to the sentencing event. Those who died having rejected salvation in their lifetimes from the millennial age and from previous ages, for that matter, sleep through. They're not involved in the second resurrection. They're reserved to the sentencing event coming up in the third resurrection. There is no second chance. I'm talking about those who were offered the opportunity for salvation but who rejected it. Those who are converted in the millennial age will be sentenced together with these who come from the post-millennial age. Now, we also have to think about the final generation of the millennial age. God is not going to cut everyone's life short at the end of the millennium. There are people who are going to be born in the last few years before the end of the millennial age. How's that going to work? We can get a pretty good picture of that if we look at Revelation chapter 20. And I'm going to read the entire chapter. And then I want to go back and point out some things that are, I think, very relevant to what we're talking about. Revelation chapter 20. And I saw an angel come down from heaven, having the key of the bottomless pit and a great chain in his hand, and laid hold of the dragon, that old serpent, which is the devil and Satan, and bound him 1,000 years, the same 1,000 years, and cast him into a bottomless pit and shut him up and set a seal upon him that he should deceive the nations no more till the 1,000 years should be fulfilled. And after that, he must be released a little season. Why? I'll explain that. And I saw thrones, and they that sat upon them, and judgment was given unto them, and I saw the souls of them that were beheaded for the witness of Jesus and for the word of God, and which had not worshipped the beast, neither his image, neither had received his mark upon their foreheads or in their hands, and they lived and reigned with Christ 1,000 years. But the rest of the dead lived not again until the 1,000 years were finished. This earlier resurrection is the first resurrection. Blessed and holy is he that has part in the first resurrection. On such the second death has no power. But they shall be priests of God and of Christ, and shall reign with him 1,000 years. And when the 1,000 years are expired, Satan shall be loosed out of his prison. What's the reason for that? And he shall go out and deceive the nations which are in the four quarters of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them together to battle, the number of whom is the sand of the sea. And they went up on the breadth of the earth and compassed the camp of the saints about and the beloved city. And fire came down from God out of heaven and devoured them. And the devil that deceived them was cast into the lake of fire and brimstone, where the beast and the false prophet had been cast previously. Read that in chapter 19, verse 20. And he shall be tormented day and night forever. And I saw a great white throne. There's where we get the name for that. And him that sat on it, from whose face the earth and heaven fled away, and there was found no place for them. And I saw the dead, small and great, stand before God, and the books were opened. And another book was opened, which is the book of life. Why is it opened at this point in time? Anyone whose name had been in it had been resurrected in the first resurrection. Obviously, it's opened again to add more names. That tells us there's opportunity being offered that they didn't have. And the dead were judged out of those things which were written in the books according to their works. This is the evaluative phase of judgment at this point, not sentencing. And the sea gave up the dead which were in it, and death and hell delivered up the dead which were in them, and they were judged, every man according to their works. Why does he say the same thing twice? This is a different event. That's why. This is the sentencing. Verse 13 refers to the sentencing phase. And death and hell were cast into the lake of fire. That should prove it. This is the second death. And whosoever was not found written in the book of life was cast into the lake of fire. This passage tells us a number of important things. I count 11 different things. It tells us that Satan is to be bound temporarily. It tells us that nations will live without deception for 1,000 years. It tells us that the saints are to be installed as rulers with Christ for 1,000 years. The first resurrection is what makes this possible. It also tells us that the rest of the dead are to remain dead for those 1,000 years. It tells us that Satan will be released again. It says he must be. And that he's going to be able to raise a very great army out of the millennial generation. People still living at that point in time. How is that going to work? It tells us that Jerusalem is going to be besieged by this army. Those who choose Satan's leadership. It tells us that Satan's armies are going to be obliterated. And that a great white throne era is going to open up after it is obliterated. It tells us that the dead are going to be raised, the books opened, and the book of life is opened. That they're to be evaluated. And then, finally, it shows us that all of the dead of all time are going to be raised for sentencing. And those who still, at that point in time, are unconverted will be consumed in the lake of fire from which there is no resurrection possible. You have to wonder, where is Satan going to get his army? Verse 8 tells us that Satan is going to gather a contingent out of the millennial generation, the number of whom is as the sand of the sea. There's going to be a lot of people, it would seem to say. Of course, there will be a large generation in the millennial age, true. But he's going to be able to gather together a great number of people into his army. Why is that going to happen? Let me pose to you an answer. The last generation of the millennium will have within it, just as we do today, just as every society has, it will have within it people who really hate God. We have people today who hate God. They won't come out and plainly say it, but you can see it by their actions. You can see it by their political activism. You can see it by their desire to drive God out of our society in every way that they possibly can. People just don't appreciate, they don't believe in God, and those who recognize the high probability that there is a God, even among them, there are people who hate God. The final generation of the millennium is going to have a contingent within it of people who have chosen to not accept salvation. They're going to be resentful of the control or the resentful of God's way of life. They just don't want that. No one is going to be born converted. We're going to be born in that generation just like they are today with the same human characteristics. Now, they won't have Satan's influence as they grow up, but they're still going to have that carnal human nature. Now, think about what happens next. All those who lived prior to that are going to be raised up. They grew up in a world filled with Satan's influence. Think what would happen if you put those people from the millennial age together with those who grew up with Satan's influence. Can you see what kind of a potent negative that would be? Can you see how those from the millennial side would circulate among those from the second resurrection era and compound the problem? You see, God wants those who come up in the second resurrection to come up in a sanitized society. Not only will they not have Satan to deal with, but they shouldn't have to deal with those who resent God and resent his way of life. God is going to use Satan, that's why he has to release him, to call that element out of the final generation of the millennium, who will live together with, who will complete their lifetimes, along with those who were raised up. Does that make any sense? It does to me. I would like to hear a better answer if there is one. But I want to pose that to you, as that is why Satan is to be released again at the end of the 1,000 years. The final generation of the millennial age will be sanitized of the resentful kind. And those who come up in the second resurrection will then live in a society free of not only Satan's influence, just as those who live in the millennial will. They won't have Satan's influence. But there will be those people who have chosen not to go God's way. He wants those people who come up on this eighth day to have the best possible opportunity for salvation that could possibly be. The second resurrection brings all of the world's dead back to life, except those who spurned their opportunity. They live out the remainder of one full generation at least. We don't know exactly how long. Some people have posed a century, and I know the verse where that comes from. But sometimes towards the end of the millennium, the ability to procreate will end. Christ said so himself, that those who come up in the resurrection don't marry and aren't given in marriage, and obviously then don't continue to have children. Those who come up in the second resurrection are not going to be procreating. They're going to just complete the lifetime that they never had, or they're going to be given at least one full generation to learn God's way, whatever amount of time it takes. And don't forget, there'll be infants coming up with them as well. They've got to have enough time to live a normal life, to learn how to live God's way, to have enough time to become fully and truly converted. That's what it's all for. But that is what this day represents. The period of opportunity for those who never had opportunity. God's plan is so fantastic in that regard. He is not willing that any should perish. But those who do, it's not going to be his fault. And ultimately, it's not going to be Satan's fault either. It's going to be their own. But he wants all people, all who have ever lived, to have the same opportunity that you and I have now, except we're living in a world filled with Satan's influence. We live in a world that is much tougher. And if you're at our first Bible study, you can realize that that first generation in the church, or the first few generations, had it toughest of all. That to do a simple thing like accept Christ and become baptized and become a Christian was a self-inflicted death sentence. That's how it worked. This generation has a higher reward. It has a tougher course to run, but it has a higher reward as a result of it. We are going to be trained as no people have ever been trained. First, we're going to walk through this society filled with Satan. We're going to overcome and make it to the end. We're going to experience the first resurrection. And then we're going to have 1,000 years of training in the millennial age to know how to deal with those who came up in the second resurrection. God has provided an incredible plan for those people. And that is what we picture in this day. That is the purpose. That is the meaning of this eighth day, this last great day. Let me conclude with this thought. Most of the people who talk about the time of the end see God as wrathful. Mr. Campbell's at it again. I think the end of the world is supposed to happen sometime next month. I don't have the exact date. I don't know that it matters. It ain't going to happen anyway. But he's done it before many times. The end of the world is coming, according to that. But they see it as a day of wrath. God is going to come and beat down society and destroy and kill. And No. God has a different plan. Granted, there's going to be some rough times that we've got to go through. Granted, there is going to be a day of physical judgment upon society. But when you think about it, once that is over, once Christ returns, his wrath is gone. There's no other occasion when he is wrathful towards society. There's no wrath in the millennial age. There's no wrath in the great white throne judgment era, the post-millennial age, except for that brief extinction of Satan's army that he raises up. Let me end by saying, you haven't lived, you haven't really lived until you see the love in God's eyes. And that love is tremendously evident in the meaning of the last great day.